Chapter 4. "How are you, Monroe?" said Red Riding Hood. "I'm glad you came down." Star walked past him, heading across the great stage, towards the set of a brilliant room that would be used tomorrow. Director Riding Hood followed, realizing after a moment that however fast he walked, Star managed to be a step or two ahead. He recognized the indication of displeasure. He had used it himself. He had had his own studio once, and he had used everything. There was no stop Star could pull that would surprise him. His task was a delivery of situations, and Star, by effective business, could not outplay him on his own grounds. Goldwyn had once interfered with him, and Ridingwood had led Goldwyn into trying to act out a part in front of 50 people, with the result that he had anticipated. His own authority had been restored. Star reached the brilliant set and stopped. "It's no good," said Ridingwood. "No imagination. I don't care how you light it." "Why did you call me about it?" Star asked, standing close to him. "Why didn't you take it up with Art?"
"I didn't ask you to come down, Monroe. You wanted to be your own supervisor."
"I'm sorry, Monroe," said Ridingwood patiently, "but I didn't ask you to come down." Star turned suddenly and walked back towards the camera setup. The eyes and open mouths of a group of visitors moved momentarily off the heroine of the picture, took in Star, and then moved vacantly back to the heroine again. They were Knights of Columbus. They had seen the host carried in procession, but this was the dream made flesh. Star stopped beside her chair. She wore a low gown which displayed the bright eczema of her chest and back. Before each take, the blemished surface was plastered over with an emollient, which was removed immediately after the take. Her hair was of the color and viscosity of drying blood, but there was starlight that actually photographed in her eyes. Before Star could speak, he heard a helpful voice behind him. "She's radiant! Absolutely radiant!" It was an assistant director, and the intention was delicate compliment. The actress was being complimented so that she did not have to strain her poor skin to bend and hear. Star was being complimented for having her under contract. Ridingwood was being remotely complimented. "Everything all right?" Star asked her pleasantly.
"Oh, it's fine," she agreed, "except for the effing publicity men."
He winked at her gently.
"We'll keep them away," he said.
Her name had become currently synonymous with the expression bitch. Presumably she had modeled herself after one of those queens in the Tarzan comics who rule mysteriously over a nation of blacks. She regarded the rest of the world as black. She was a necessary evil borrowed for a single picture. Ridingwood walked with Star towards the door of the stage.
"Everything's all right," the director said. "She's as good as she can be."
They were out of hearing range, and Star stopped suddenly and looked at Red with blazing eyes. "You've been photographing crap," he said. "Do you know what she reminds me of on the rushes? Miss Foodstuffs."
"I'm trying to get the best performance. Come along with me," said Star abruptly.
"With you?
Shall I tell them to rest?"
"Leave it as it is," said Star, pushing the padded outer door. His car and chauffeur waited outside. Minutes were precious most days.
"Get in," said Star.
Red knew now it was serious. He even knew all at once what was the matter. The girl had got the whip hand on him the first day with her cold, lashing tongue. He was a peace-loving man, and he had let her walk through her part, cold, rather than cause trouble. Star spoke into his thoughts.
"You can't handle her," he said. "I told you what I wanted. I wanted her mean, and she comes out bored."
"I'm afraid we'll have to call it off, Red."
"The picture?"
"No, I'm putting Harley on it."
"All right, Monroe."
"I'm sorry, Red. We'll try something else another time." The car drew up in front of Star's office.
"Shall I finish this take?" said Red.
"It's being done now," said Star grimly. "Harley's in there."
"What the hell?"
"He went in when we came out. I had him read the script last night."
"Now listen, Monroe."
"It's my busy day, Red," said Star tersely. "You lost interest about 3 days ago." It was a sorry mess, Ridingwood thought. It meant he would have slight, very slight loss of position. It probably meant that he could not have a third wife just now, as he had planned. There wasn't even the satisfaction of raising a row about it. If you disagreed with Star, you did not advertise it. Star was his world's great customer, who was always almost always right.
How about my coat? He asked suddenly. I left it over a chair on the set.
I know you did, said Starr. Here it is. He was trying so hard to be charitable about Ridingwood's lapse that he had forgotten that he had it in his hand.
Mr. Starr's projection room was a miniature picture theater with four rows of overstuffed chairs. In front of the front row ran long tables with dim lamps, buzzers, and telephones. Against the wall was an upright piano, left there since the early days of sound. The room had been redecorated and reupholstered only a year before, but already it was ragged again with work and hours. Here Starr sat at 2:30 and again at 6:30, watching the lengths of film taken during the day. There was often a savage tensity about the occasion. He was dealing with fait accompli, the net results of months of buying, planning, writing and rewriting, casting, constructing, lighting, rehearsing, and shooting, the fruit of brilliant hunches or of counsels of despair, of lethargy, conspiracy, and sweat. At this point, the tortuous maneuver was staged and in suspension. There were reports from the battle line. Besides Starr, there were present the representatives of all technical departments, together with the supervisors and unit managers of the pictures concerned. The directors did not appear at these showings, officially because their work was considered done, actually because few punches were pulled here as money ran out in silver spools. There had evolved a delicate staying away. The staff was already assembled. Starr came in and took his place quickly, and the murmur of conversation died away. As he sat back and drew his thin knee up beside him in the chair, the lights in the room went out. There was the flare of a match in the back row, then silence. On the screen, a troop of French Canadians pushed their canoes up a rapids. The scene had been photographed in a studio tank, and at the end of each take, after the director's voice could be heard saying, "Cut!" the actors on the screen relaxed and wiped their brows and sometimes laughed hilariously, and the water in the tank stopped flowing and the illusion ceased. Except to name his choice from each set of takes, and to remark that it was a good process, Starr made no comment. The next scene, still in the rapids, called for dialogue between the Canadian girl, Claudette Colbert, and the Coulier du Bois, Ronald Coleman, with her looking down at him from a canoe. After a few strips had run through, Starr spoke up suddenly. "Has the tank been dismantled?"
"Yes, sir."
"Monroe, they needed it for..." Starr cut in peremptorily. "Have it set up again right away. Let's have that second take again." The lights went on momentarily. One of the unit managers left his chair and came and stood in front of Starr. "A beautifully acted scene, thrown away," raged Starr quietly. "It wasn't centered. The camera was set up so it caught the beautiful top of Claudette's head all the time she was talking. That's just what we want, isn't it? That's just what people go to see, the top of a beautiful girl's head. Tell Temmie could have saved wear and tear by using her stand-in." The lights went out again. The unit manager squatted by Starr's chair to be out of the way. The take was run again. "Do you see now?" asked Starr. "And there's a hair in the picture, there on the right, see it? Find out if it's in the projector or the film." At the very end of the take, Claudette Colbert slowly lifted her head, revealing her great liquid eyes. "That's what we should have had all the way," said Starr. "She gave a fine performance, too. See if you can fit it in tomorrow or late this afternoon." Pete Zabris would not have made a slip like that. There were not six cameramen in the industry you could entirely trust. The lights went on. The supervisor and unit manager for that picture went out.
"Monroe, this stuff was shot yesterday. It came through late last night."
The room darkened. On the screen appeared the head of Siva, immense and imperturbable, oblivious to the fact that in a few hours it was to be washed away in a flood. Around it milled a crowd of the faithful.
"When you take that scene again," said Starr suddenly, "put a couple of little kids up on top. You better check about whether it's reverent or not, but I think it's all right. Kids will do anything."
"Yes, Monroe." A silver belt with stars cut out of it. Smith, Jones, or Brown... Personal. Will the woman with a silver belt who... With another picture, the scene shifted to New York. A gangster story. And suddenly Starr became restive. That scene's trash, he called suddenly in the darkness. It's badly written, it's miscast, it accomplishes nothing. Those types aren't tough. They look like a lot of dressed-up lollipops. What the hell is the matter, Lee?
The scene was written on the set this morning, said Lee Capper. Burton wanted to get all the stuff on stage six.
Well, it's trash, and so is this one. There is no use printing stuff like that. She doesn't believe what she's saying. Neither does Carrie. I love you in a close-up. They'll cluck you out of the house. And the girl's overdressed.
In the darkness, a signal was given. The projector stopped. The lights went on. The room waited in utter silence. Star's face was expressionless.
Who wrote the scene? He asked after a minute.
Wiley White.
Is he sober?
Sure he is, Star considered.
Put about four writers on that scene tonight, he said. See who we've got. Is Sidney Howard here yet?
He got in this morning.
Talk to him about it. Explain to him what I want there. The girl is in deadly terror. She's stalling. It's as simple as that. People don't have three emotions at once. And Capper,
the art director leaned forward out of the second row.
Yeah? There's something the matter with that set.
There were little glances exchanged all over the room.
What is it, Monroe?
You tell me, said Starr. It's crowded. It doesn't carry your eye out. It looks cheap.
It wasn't.
I know it wasn't. There's not much the matter, but there's something. Go over and take a look tonight. It may be too much furniture, or the wrong kind. Perhaps a window would help. Couldn't you force the perspective in that hall a little more?
I'll see what I can do.
Capper edged his way out of the row, looking at his watch.
I'll have to get at it right away, he said. I'll work tonight, and we'll put it up in the morning.
All right. Lee, you can shoot around those scenes, can't you?
I think so, Monroe.
I take the blame for this. Have you got the fight stuff?
Coming up now.
Star nodded. Capper hurried out, and the room went dark again. On the screen, four men staged a terrific socking match in a cellar. Star laughed.
Look at Tracy, he said. Look at him go down after that guy. I bet he's been in a few.
The men fought over and over, always the same fight. Always at the end they faced each other, smiling, sometimes touching the opponent in a friendly gesture on the shoulder. The only one in danger was the stuntman, a pug who could have murdered the other three. He was in danger only if they swung wild and didn't follow the blows he had taught them. Even so, the youngest actor was afraid for his face, and the director had covered his flinches with ingenious angles and interpositions. And then two men met endlessly in a door, recognized each other, and went on. They met, they started, they went on. Then a little girl read underneath a tree, with a boy reading on a limb of the tree above. The little girl was bored and wanted to talk to the boy. He would pay no attention. The core of the apple he was eating fell on the little girl's head. A voice spoke up out of the darkness.
It's pretty long, isn't it, Monroe?
Not a bit, said Star. It's nice. It has a nice feeling.
I just thought it was long.
Sometimes 10 feet can be too long. Sometimes a scene 200 feet can be too short.
I want to speak to the cutter before he touches this scene. This is something that'll be remembered in the picture.
The oracle had spoken. There was nothing to question or argue. Star must be right, always. Not most of the time, but always. Or the structure would melt down like gradual butter. Another hour passed. Dreams hung in fragments at the far end of the room. Suffered analysis. Passed. To be dreamed in crowds, or else discarded. The end was signaled by two tests, a character man and a girl. After the rushes, which had a tense rhythm of their own, the tests were smooth and finished. The observers settled in their chairs. Star's foot slipped to the floor. Opinions were welcome. One of the technical men let it be known that he would willingly cohabit with a girl. The rest were indifferent.
Somebody sent up a test of that girl 2 years ago. She must be getting around, but she isn't getting any better.
But the man's good. Can't we use him as the old Russian prince in Steps?
He is an old Russian prince, said the casting director. But he's ashamed of it. He's a Red. And that's one part he says he wouldn't play.
It's the only part he could play, said Star.
The lights went on. Star rolled his gum into its wrapper and put it in an ashtray. He turned questioningly to his secretary.
The process is on stage 2, she said.
He looked in briefly at the processes,
moving pictures taken against a background of other moving pictures by an ingenious device. There was a meeting in Marcus's office on the subject of Manon with a happy ending, and Starr had his say on that as he had had before. It had been making money without a happy ending for a century and a half. He was obdurate. At this time in the afternoon, he was at his most fluent, and the opposition faded into another subject. They would lend a dozen stars to the benefit for those the quake had made homeless at Long Beach. In a sudden burst of giving, five of them, all at once, made up a purse of $25,000. They gave well, but not as poor men give. It was not charity. At his office, there was word from the oculist to whom he had sent Pete Zavras that the cameraman's eyes were 19/20, approximately perfect. He had written a letter that Zavras was having photostated. Starr walked around his office cockily while Miss Doolin admired him. Prince Aga had dropped in to thank him for his afternoon on the sets, and while they talked, a cryptic word came from a supervisor that some writers named Tarleton had found out and were about to quit. "These are good writers," Starr explained to Prince Aga, "and we don't have good writers out here." "Why, you can hire anyone," exclaimed his visitor in surprise. "Oh, we hire them, but when they get out here, they're not good writers, so we have to work with the material we have." "Such as what?" "Anybody that'll accept the system and stay decently sober. We have all sorts of people. Disappointed poets, one-hit playwrights, college girls. We put them on an idea in pairs, and if it slows down, we put two more writers working behind them. I've had as many as three pairs working independently on the same idea." "Do they like that?" "Not if they know about it. They're not geniuses. None of them could make as much any other way. But these Tarletons are a husband and wife team from the East, pretty good playwrights. They've just found out they're not alone on the story, and it shocks them. Shocks their sense of unity. That's the word they'll use." "But what does make the unity?" Starr hesitated. His face was grim, except that his eyes twinkled. "I'm the unity," he said. "Come and see us again." He saw the Tarletons. He told them he liked their work, looking at Mrs. Tarleton as if he could read her handwriting through the typescript. He told them kindly that he was taking them from the picture and putting them on another, where there was less pressure, more time. As he had half expected, they begged to stay on the first picture, seeing a quicker credit, even though it was shared with others. The system was a shame, he admitted, gross, commercial, to be deplored. He had originated it, a fact that he did not mention. When they had gone, Miss Doolin came in, triumphant. "Mr. Starr, the lady with the belt is on the phone." Starr walked into his office alone and sat down behind his desk and picked up the phone with a great sinking of his stomach. He did not know what he wanted. He had not thought about the matter as he had thought about the matter of Pete Zavras. At first, he'd only wanted to know if they were professional people, if the woman was an actress who had got herself up to look like Minna, as he had once had a young actress made up like Claudette Colbert and photographed her from the same angles. "Hello?" he said. "Hello?" As he searched the short, rather surprised word for a vibration of last night, the feeling of terror began to steal over him, and he choked it off with an effort of will. "Well, you were hard to find," he said. "Smith. And you moved here recently. That was all we had. And the silver belt." "Oh, yes," the voice said, still uneasy, unpoised. "I had on a silver belt last night." "Now, where from here?" "Who are you?" the voice said, with a touch of flurried bourgeois dignity. "My name is Monroe Starr," he said. A pause. It was a name that never appeared on the screen, and she seemed to have trouble placing it.
"Oh, yes. Yes, you were the husband of Minna Davis."
"Yes." Was it a trick? As the whole vision of last night came back to him, the very skin with that peculiar radiance as if phosphorus had touched it, he thought whether it might not be a trick to reach him from somewhere. Not Minna, and yet Minna. The curtains blew suddenly into the room, the papers whispered on his desk, and his heart cringed faintly at the intense reality of the day outside his window. If he could go out now this way, what would happen if he saw her again? The starry-veiled expression,
the mouth strongly formed for poor, brave human laughter.
"I'd like to see you. Would you like to come to the studio?"
Again the hesitancy, then a blank refusal.
"Oh, I don't think I ought to. I'm awfully sorry."
This last was purely formal, a brush-off, a final axe. Ordinary skin-deep vanity came to Star's aid, adding persuasion to his urgency.
"I'd like to see you," he said. "There's a reason."
"Well, I'm afraid that..."
"Could I come and see you?"
A pause again, not from hesitation he felt, but to assemble her answer.
"There's something you don't know," she said finally.
"Oh, you're probably married," he was impatient. "It has nothing to do with that. I asked you to come here openly. Bring your husband if you have one."
It's quite impossible."
"Why?"
"I feel silly even talking to you, but your secretary insisted. I thought I'd dropped something in the flood last night and you'd found it.
I want very much to see you for 5 minutes."
"To put me in the movies?"
"That wasn't my idea." There was such a long pause that he thought he had offended her.
"Where could I meet you?" she asked unexpectedly.
"Here? At your house?"
"No, somewhere outside."
Suddenly Star could think of no place. His own house, a restaurant? Where did people meet? A house of assignation? A cocktail bar?
"I'll meet you somewhere at 9 o'clock, she said.
"That's impossible, I'm afraid."
"Then never mind."
"All right, then, 9 o'clock. But can we make it near here? There's a drugstore on Wiltshire." It was 5:45. There were two men outside who had come every day at this time, only to be postponed. This was an hour of fatigue. The men's business was not so important that it must be seen to, nor so insignificant that it could be ignored. So he postponed it again and sat motionless at his desk for a moment, thinking about Russia. Not so much about Russia as about the picture about Russia, which would consume a hopeless half hour presently. He knew there were many stories about Russia, not to mention the story, and he had employed a squad of writers and research men for over a year. But all the stories involved had the wrong feel. He felt it could be told in terms of the American 13 states, but it kept coming out different, in new terms, that opened unpleasant possibilities and problems. He considered he was very fair to Russia. He had no desire to make anything but a sympathetic picture, but it kept turning into a headache.
"Mr. Starr, Mr. Drummond's outside, and Mr. Kirstoff and Mrs. Cornhill about the Russian picture."
"All right, send them in." Afterwards, from 6:30 to 7:30, he watched the afternoon rushes. Except for his engagement with a girl, he would ordinarily have spent the early evening in the projection room or the dubbing room, but it had been a late night with the earthquake, and he decided to go to dinner. Coming in through his front office, he found Pete Zavras waiting, his arm in a sling.
"You are the Aeschylus and the Euripides of the moving picture," said Zavras simply. "Also the Aristophanes and the Menander."
He bowed.
"Who are they?" asked Starr, smiling. "They are my countrymen. I didn't know you made pictures in Greece." "You're joking with me, Monroe," said Zavras. "I want to say you are as dandy a fellow as they come. You have saved me, 100%.
"You feel all right now?"
"My arm is nothing. It feels like someone kisses me there. It was worth doing what I did if this is the outcome."
"So how did you happen to do it here?" Starr asked curiously.
"Before the Delphic Oracle," said Zavras. "The Oedipus who solved the riddle. I wish I had my hands on the son of a bitch who started the story."
"You make me sorry I didn't get an education," said Starr.
"It isn't worth a damn," said Pete. "I took my baccalaureate in Salonika, and look how I ended up."
"Not quite," said Starr.
"If you want anybody's throat cut any time, day or night," said Zavras, "my number is in the book."
Starr closed his eyes and opened them again. Zavras' silhouette had blurred a little against the sun. He hung on to the table behind him and said in an ordinary voice, "Good luck, Pete." The room was almost black, but he made his feet move, following a pattern, into his office and waited till the door clicked shut before he felt for the pills. The water decanter clattered against the table. The glass clacked. He sat down in a big chair, waiting for the Benzedrine to take effect before he went to dinner. As Star walked back from the commissary, a hand waved at him from an open roadster. From the head showing over the back, he recognized a young actor and his girl, and watched them disappear through the gate, already part of the summer twilight. Little by little, he was losing the feel of such things, until it seemed that Minna had taken their poignancy with her. His appreciation of splendor was fading, so that presently the luxury of eternal mourning would depart. A childish association of Minna with the material heavens made him, when he reached his office, order out his roadster for the first time this year. The big limousine seemed heavy with remembered conferences or exhausted sleep. Leaving the studio, he was still tense, but the open car pulled the summer evening up close, and he looked at it. There was a moon down at the end of the boulevard, and it was a good illusion that it was a different moon every evening, every year. Other lights shone in Hollywood since Minna's death. In the open markets, lemons and grapefruit and green apples slanted a misty glare into the street. Ahead of him, the stop signal of a car winked violet, and at another crossing, he watched it wink again. Everywhere, floodlights raked the sky. On an empty corner, two mysterious men moved a gleaming drum in pointless arcs over the heavens. In the drugstore, a woman stood by the candy counter. She was tall, almost as tall as Star, and embarrassed. Obviously, it was a situation for her, and if Star had not looked as he did, most considerate and polite, she would not have gone through with it. They said hello and walked out without another word, scarcely a glance. Yet before they reached the curb, Star knew. This was just exactly a pretty American woman and nothing more. No beauty like Minna.
"Where are we going?" she asked. "I thought there'd be a chauffeur." "Never mind, I'm a good boxer."
"Boxer?"
That didn't sound very polite, she forced a smile. "But you people are supposed to be such horrors."
The conception of himself as sinister amused Star. Then suddenly it failed to amuse him.
"Why did you want to see me?" she asked as she got in.
He stood motionless, wanting to tell her to get out immediately, but she had relaxed in the car, and he knew the unfortunate situation was of his own making. He shut his teeth and walked round to get in. The street lamp fell full upon her face, and it was difficult to believe that this was the girl of last night. He saw no resemblance to Minna at all. "I'll run you home," he said. "Where do you live?"
"Run me home?" She was startled. "There's no hurry. I'm sorry if I offended you."
"No, it was nice of you to come. I've been stupid. Last night I had an idea that you were an exact double for someone I knew. It was dark and the light was in my eyes." She was offended. He had reproached her for not looking like someone else.
"It was just that," she said. "That's funny."
They rode in silence for a minute.
"You were married to Minna Davis, weren't you?" she said with a flash of intuition. "Excuse me for referring to it."
He was driving as fast as he could without making it conspicuous.
"I'm quite a different type from Minna Davis," she said, "if that's who you meant. You might have referred to the girl who was with me. She looks more like Minna Davis than I do."
That was of no interest now. The thing was to get this over quick and forget it.
"Could it have been her?" she asked. "She lives next door."
"Not possibly," he said. "I remember the silver belt you..."
"That was me, all right."
They were northwest of Sunset, climbing one of the canyons through the hills. Lighted bungalows rose along the winding road, and the electric current that animated them sweated into the evening air as radio sound.
"You see that last highest light? Kathleen lives there. I live just over the top of the hill."
A moment later, she said,
"Stop here."
"I thought you said over the top."
"I want to stop at Kathleen's."
"I'm afraid I'm..."
"I want to get out here myself," she said impatiently.
Star slid out after her. She started towards a new little house, almost roofed over by a single willow tree, and automatically he followed her to the steps. She rang a bell and turned to say goodnight.
"I'm sorry you were disappointed," she said.
He was sorry for her now. Sorry for them both.
It was my fault. Good night. A wedge of light came out the opening door, and as a girl's voice inquired, "Who is it?" Star looked up. There she was. Face and form and smile against the light from inside. It was Minna's face. The skin with its peculiar radiance, as if phosphorus had touched it. The mouth with its warm line that never counted costs. And over all, the haunting jollity that had fascinated a generation. With a leap, his heart went out of him, as it had the night before. Only this time it stayed out there with a vast beneficence.
"Oh, Edna, you can't come in," the girl said. "I've been cleaning, and the house is full of ammonia smell."
Edna began to laugh, bold and loud.
"I believe it was you he wanted to see, Kathleen," she said.
Star's eyes and Kathleen's met and tangled. For an instant they made love, as no one ever dares to do after. Their glance was slower than an embrace, more urgent than a call.
"He telephoned me," said Edna. "It seems he thought..."
Star interrupted, stepping forward into the light.
"I was afraid we were rude at the studio yesterday evening."
But there were no words for what he really said. She listened closely without shame. Life flared high in them both. Edna seemed at a distance and in darkness.
"You weren't rude," said Kathleen.
A cool wind blew the brown curls around her forehead.
"We had no business there."
"I hope you'll both," Star said, "come and make a tour of the studio."
"Who are you? Somebody important?" "He was Minna Davis's husband. He's a producer," said Edna, as if it were a rare joke. "And this isn't at all what he just told me. I think he has a crush on you."
"Shut up, Edna," said Kathleen sharply. As if suddenly realizing her offensiveness, Edna said,
"Phone me, will you?"
and stalked away towards the road. But she carried their secret with her. She had seen a spark pass between them in the darkness.
"I remember you," Kathleen said to Star. "You got us out of the flood."
Now what? The other woman was more missed in her absence. They were alone, and on too slim a basis for what had passed already. They existed nowhere. His world seemed far away. She had no world at all, except the idol's head, the half-open door.
"You're Irish," he said, trying to build one for her. She nodded. "I've lived in London a long time. I didn't think you could tell."
The wild green eyes of a bus sped up the road in the darkness. They were silent until it went by.
"Your friend Edna didn't like me," he said. "I think it was the word producer."
"She's just come out here, too. She's a silly creature who means no harm. I shouldn't be afraid of you."
She searched his face. She thought, like everyone, that he seemed tired. Then she forgot it at the impression he gave of a brazier out of doors on a cool night.
"I suppose the girls are all after you to put them on the screen."
"They've given up," he said. This was an understatement. They were all there, he knew, just over the threshold. But they had been there so long that their clamoring voices were no more than the sound of traffic in the street. But his position remained more than royal. A king could make only one queen. Star, at least so they supposed, could make many.
"I'm thinking that it would turn you into a cynic," she said. "You didn't want to put me in pictures?"
"No."
"That's good. I'm no actress. Once in London, a man came up to me in the Carlton and asked me to make a test. But I thought a while, and finally I didn't go."
They had been standing nearly motionless, as if in a moment he would leave and she would go in. Star laughed suddenly.
"I feel as if I had my foot in the door, like a collector."
She laughed too.
"I'm sorry I can't ask you in. Shall I get my reefer and sit outside?"
"No."
He scarcely knew why he felt it was time to go. He might see her again, he might not. It was just as well this way.
"You'll come to the studio?" he said. "I can't promise to go around with you, but if you come, you must be sure to send word to my office."
A frown, the shadow of a hair in breadth, appeared between her eyes.
"I'm not sure," she said, "but I'm very much obliged."
He knew that for some reason she would not come. In an instant, she had slipped away from him. They both sensed that the moment was played out. He must go, even though he went nowhere, and it left him with nothing.
Practically, vulgarly, he did not have her telephone number, or even her name. But it seemed impossible to ask for them now. She walked with him to the car, her glowing beauty and her unexplored novelty pressing up against him. But there was a foot of moonlight between them when they came out of the shadow. "Is this all?" he said spontaneously. He saw regret in her face, but there was a flick of the lip also, a bending of the smile toward some indirection, a momentary dropping and lifting of a curtain over a forbidden passage.
"I do hope we'll meet again," she said, almost formally.
"I'd be sorry if we didn't." They were distant for a moment. But as he turned his car in the next drive and came back with her still waiting, and waved and drove on, he felt exalted and happy. He was glad that there was beauty in the world that would not be weighed in the scales of the casting department. But at home, he felt a curious loneliness as his butler made him tea in the samovar. It was the old hurt come back, heavy and delightful. When he took up the first of two scripts that were his evening stint, that presently he would visualize line by line on the screen, he waited a moment, thinking of Minna. He explained to her that it was really nothing, that no one could ever be like she was, that he was sorry.
That was substantially a day of stars. I don't know about the illness, when it started, etc., because he was secretive. But I know he fainted a couple of times that month because Father told me. Prince Aga is my authority for the luncheon in the commissary, where he told them he was going to make a picture that would lose money, which was something, considering the men he had to deal with, and that he held a big block of stock and had a profit-sharing contract. And Wiley White told me a lot, which I believed because he felt Star intensely, with a mixture of jealousy and admiration. As for me, I was head over heels in love with him then, and you can take what I say for what it's worth.
End of Disc 2. Disc 3.